This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Real figures may be higher, but officially of the 166 inmates in Guanmo, 102 are currently on hunger strike. Of these, 30 are being force-fed through a nasal tube, and 3 are in the hospital. The 166 prisoners have been there 11 and a half years, and 90% of them haven't been charged with a crime. From Climate Progress, subsection of thinkprogress.org, fish are fleeing climate-warmed waters and heading for the Earth's poles. For more than 30 years, ocean fish and mammals have migrated away from warming equatorial waters and toward the poles, providing more evidence climate change has already had broad global consequences. Fish and other sea life have been heading toward the Earth's poles for more than 3 decades, a mass migration to cooler waters that provides more evidence of a rapidly warming planet and has repercussions for fish harvests around the globe. According to a first-of-its-kind study released Wednesday, the study in the journal Nature found that significant numbers of 968 species of fish and invertebrates examined by the University of British Columbia researchers moved to escape the warming waters of their original habitats. Previous studies had demonstrated the same phenomenon for specific places in the world's oceans. The authors said their research was the first to assess a migration worldwide and to look back as far as 1970. The research is more confirmation that global climate change is real and has been real for a long time. It's not something in the distant future. It is well underway. From Mike Wall, writing in Wonderground, the superactive sunspot responsible for unleashing the 3 most powerful solar flares of 2013 within a 24-hour stretch this week is slowly rotating toward Earth and will likely be facing our planet by the weekend. Experts say active region 1748 unleashed 3 monster solar flares between Sunday and Monday. Every one of the solar storms registered as an X-class flare, the most powerful type, with each successive event stronger than the last, culminating in an X3.2 megablast Monday night. These solar explosions did not affect Earth, since it was not facing our planet at the time, but the sunspot is now circling into view. So, future flares and any associated eruptions of superhot solar plasma called coronal mass ejections could potentially target our planet. In a couple of days, scientists say it will be far enough onto the disk that any CMEs we got would probably have some impact on Earth. AR 1748 should be near the center of the solar disk, by our perspective, by around Saturday. Now, exiting the article and turning to my opinion, here's why this is news. This thing's turning around like a giant tank turret. Our friendly old sun has put us in the crosshairs of an unusual sunspot cycle. If you're on an aircraft, while a large X-flare and or coronal mass ejection hits, well, you may not survive. X-flares arrive in a few hours, while CMEs can take days, and satellites and airplane computers can be effectively bricked by a big enough solar storm. And historically, power grids and even a transformer for a New Jersey nuclear power plant have been subject to melting. A really large event is even more unlikely this Saturday, but it's happened before, and if the Carrington event of 1859, for example, were to be repeated, cities would burn. So, I guess the way you handle this is if you're taking a plane sometime around Saturday or thereafter, and you hear on the radio that giant flare, you know, let's say X5.9 or something is headed forward towards the Earth, you might want to consider getting on that plane. Now, returning to the article by Mike Wall on Wonderground, If the sunspot sends something off, we can expect to get some coronal mass ejection sort of head-on at that point. Sunspots are temporary dark and relatively cool patches on our star's surface where the local magnetic field is very strong. They frequently, but not always, serve as staging grounds for powerful solar flares and CMEs. About the size of 2 Earths, AR 1748 is not a particularly large sunspot. Sunspots can stretch for tens of thousands of miles across the solar surface, but the active region does appear to have an unusually complex structure. Because AR 1748 is near the sun's limb at the moment, it's tough to say if its complexity is increasing, which could be an indicator of future activity, but things should become clear in the next day or so as scientists get a better look at the sunspot. While researchers will take AR 1748's complexity and evolution into account when gauging its future eruption potential, they'll also look closely at its past behavior. One of the biggest indicators, one of the scientists said, of an active region flaring is that it has already flared. In this case, the fact that it's already put out a really large flare gives it a strong possibility that it'll do it again. Scientists give AR-1748 a 40 to 50% chance of firing off another X-class flare, he added, though this probability is a rough estimate that could change as future information becomes available. If X-class flares aimed at Earth can have consequences on a planet-wide scale, triggering widespread radio blackouts and long-lasting radiation storms. And departing from that text once again, also bricking electronic equipment, wiping out satellites, that sort of thing. You're listening to Press Watch. This is KBOO Portland. KBOO 90.7, KBOO.FM. Why not pull up KBOO.FM and check it out? Have a look at the programs list. I bet there's something on there that you like. Give a donation. There's a little tip jar on the upper right side of the screen, KBOO.FM. Give you a chance to get your favorite t-shirt, anything that you like. KBOO.FM. Why cops and prosecutors get away with throwing innocents in prisons. This week's Jim Crow drug war report comes from the Black Agenda report by Margaret Kimberly. The ironically named criminal justice system in this country is good at prosecuting and creating many criminals, but not very good at producing any justice. The United States would not have the largest prison population of any other country on earth if it did not also have the harshest prosecution and sentencing system of any other country. America's addiction to racism and violence creates outright criminality among police and prosecutors. Their misconduct is tolerated and even encouraged, and the result is an untold number of innocent people in jail. In 1989, five New York City teenagers, four black and one Latino, were convicted of raping and assaulting a then-anonymous woman known as the Central Park Jogger. In the now infamous case, the teens were coerced into giving false videotaped confessions. None of the established procedures for interviewing minors were in place, and police and prosecutors broke the law in order to convict them. Unable to pay for good legal representation and convicted in the court of public opinion, the five spent between 6 and 13 years behind bars. In 2002, a sole perpetrator confessed to the attack. DNA tests proved his guilt, and the convictions were vacated. Thanks to the new documentary, The Central Park Five, the prosecutors who orchestrated the travesty have come under scrutiny, but none of them have suffered as a result of their actions legally. Until very recently, prosecutor Elizabeth Lederer bragged about her involvement in the case and included it in her biography. She is still a law professor at Columbia University. It isn't clear why anyone would want her to teach anything about the law, but there she sits in the lap of establishment legal profession luxury. When an outraged citizen circulated a petition pressuring Columbia to fire Lederer, the wagon circled around her and the media excoriated those who only wanted accountability and justice. The prosecutors who orchestrated the travesty have come under scrutiny, but none of them have suffered as a result of their actions. Lederer's boss, Linda Fairstein, also made quite a name for herself in the ensuing years. She became a best-selling author and a wealthy woman after the prosecution. Her behavior in getting the teens arrested and convicted was particularly egregious. Quoting, Fairstein gruffly dismissed Yusuf Salam's aunt and threatened his mentor, Brooklyn prosecutor, federal prosecutor David Nocenti, in refusing to let them see the teen while he was being interrogated. According to both Sharon Salam and Timothy Sullivan's book on the case, Unequal Verdicts, Fairstein then called her husband to demand the home number of Nocenti's then-boss, Brooklyn U.S. Attorney Andrew Maloney, so she could get the young attorney fired. According to court records, Fairstein even tried to block Sharon Salam from interrupting the interrogation, despite Sharon's claim that Yusuf was 15, and too young to be questioned without an adult present. The five men will not get back the years they lost in prison, but the world knows they were innocent. However, the city of New York still maintains their guilt and fights every effort to bring them some financial justice. The exonerated men filed a $250 million lawsuit in 2003, but the city has spent the last 10 years defending itself and even attempting to intimidate the documentary producers by issuing subpoenas for their video footage. In New York, others still languish in jail, sometimes for decades, because of a law enforcement corruption. There are now 50 murder convictions under review by the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office because of one man, retired Detective Louis Scarsella. His criminal behavior came to light when an innocent white man, David Ranta, was freed after spending 23 years in jail because Scarsella coached a witness into falsely identifying him as a killer. When Scarsella wanted an individual convicted, he stopped at nothing to make his case. He took informants out of jail and allowed them to smoke crack and visit prostitutes. Supposed witnesses deny having spoken to him or were told whom to pick out of a line, or told what to say. One prostitute allegedly witnessed six different murders investigated by Scarsella and testified under oath every time. The district attorney's office in New York is now investigating these cases, but they can hardly investigate themselves. How did supposedly smart people allow the same person to testify numerous times and that she had witnessed murders? The answer is obvious. Anyone who knows the implausibility of these situations must have also noticed that the Scarcellas of the New York Police Department worked hand-in-hand with prosecutors to prosecute as many people as possible and that their bad behavior was condoned. Shabada Shakur is serving the 26th year of a 40-year sentence in part because Scarcella claimed he made self-incriminating statements. There are no records of such a statement, yet Shakur was convicted anyway. Derek Hamilton was paroled after serving 21 years in prison and now strives to prove he was set up by Scarcella. Quoting, he told me, he told me, I know you didn't commit this murder, but I don't care, end quote. Those words may have been spoken by one man, but they represent the thinking of an entire system and its attitudes towards black people. One half of all wrongfully convicted prisoners are black. Mass incarceration depends on an assembly line of conviction and imprisonment, and too few who are charged with caring about justice really do. It is indisputable that America strives to put as many black people behind bars as possible. Inevitably, some white people will be caught up too, but the goal of criminal justice is to make every black person a criminal. No one knows how many Shabada Shakurs and Derek Hamiltons there are behind bars in New York and across the country. Any discussion of ending mass incarceration must address these travesties, which take place on a daily basis. The crooked prosecutors and cops must be held accountable. They ought to be charged criminally themselves. There is no incentive for them to obey the law if they are not. The exonerated men and women are expected to quietly accept their misfortune and disappear without expecting any relief. And since that is the expectation for all black people, we are known to be innocent, she writes, but the system doesn't care. Kevin Engel in the Guildfordian writes, while the U.S. comprises only 5% of the global population, it contains 25% of the world's prison population. About one in every 31 adults in the U.S. is under the control of the correction system, whether they be in prison, in jail, or on supervised release. Either we are home to the most evil people on earth, or we are doing something vastly counterproductive, wrote former Virginia Senator Jim Webb in 2009. The prison population has grown roughly 790% over the past 30 years, while violent crime has significantly decreased. Hal Woltz, constitutional expert, author of Justice Denied, the United States versus the People, and former inmate, told the Guildfordian that this anomaly is caused primarily by three things. First, Congress has created over 14,000 laws with prison as a penalty, many of which are for behaviors never before considered criminal. Secondly, the power and discretion of sentencing has been taken away from courts and juries and given to public prosecutors through legislation that requires mandatory sentences. And third, Woltz continued, an enormous industry has sprung up around this anomaly, which has developed significant political clout. Now, departing from this text, I remember too well being arrested and thrown in jail for yelling at a couple of business owners who, among other things, threatened me with the presence of their gun. I resisted the prison pipeline, so to speak. We have a show on KBOO, by the way, called Prison Pipeline. Look it up. Because I hired a lawyer, and that messed things up and made them mad, so they changed the charges and tried to put me in jail for 10 years for allegedly resisting arrest and fighting it as hard as I could with the jury trial. A year later, I was finally sentenced to volunteer work at KBOO. My crime turned out to be a truly obscure law, which had been passed more than a century ago to keep people from fighting outside of bars, apparently. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Now, turning to world news, Russia slams no-fly zone proposals for Syria. Well, we'll get to that in just a moment, but someone has called in. Number to call, 503-231-8187, and Kenny's on the line.
Hey, Teresa.
Hi.
Yeah, kind of on with your point, what you were just talking about anyways, but did you hear about the latest FBI killing there?
No.
Of Malcolm Shabazz?
Oh, in Mexico.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you heard the story before that, the FBI picked him up in an airport on his way. He was scheduled a flight to go to Iran for some type of meeting out there or something. FBI picked him up. Next thing you know, he's killed in Chicago, or in Mexico, rather.
Huh.
Pretty fishy circumstances.
It is fishy, and
pretty good against the government too. I don't know if you've seen some of his videos on YouTube and whatnot, but he had a good message. And just like his grandfather, Malcolm X, he's killed also by our government.
It reminds me, in the 1980s, U.S. Congressional Representative Henry B. Gonzalez succeeded to the Banking Committee, and he was approaching 80 years old, but he was a boxer and stayed in shape, and he was in San Antonio, his home district, when he was approached by a man who pulled a pistol, and Henry B. Gonzalez punched the man so quickly and so hard in the face that he fell to the ground, then got up confused and ran away, and the pistol was recovered. The pistol turned out to be made of ceramics, and the only people in the United States who had access to that sort of weapon were the U.S. Secret Police.
I mean, people need this. We need to start waking up again.
Yeah, there's reason for suspicion for that killing in Mexico. Thanks a lot for that call. Number to call, 503-231-8187. This is from Lina Valverde in Radio Havana, Cuba. Russia wants an urgent international conference on Syria and has objected to setting up a no-fly zone over the country. That's according to the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Gennady Gatilov. Quoting Gatilov, "We believe it necessary for the representatives of the Syrian government in opposition to find a way to fully implement the Geneva communique of June 30th, 2012. He said that during Ban Ki-moon's visit to Russia. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry agreed recently that Moscow and Washington would push Damascus and the opposition to discuss a political solution to the deadly two-year-old crisis. Gatilov noted that Ban Ki-moon shares a similar position on the issue. Meanwhile, the Russian diplomat criticized the U.N. Secretariat's approach to Damascus' request to investigate the use of chemical weapons near the city of Aleppo. Quoting Gatilov, "We see the need for U.N. Secretariat to respond to that request," adding the Secretariat's position was inconsistent and politicized. He also slammed the initiatives to create humanitarian corridors and impose a no-fly zone, saying such decisions were destructive and could only be made by the UN Security Council, quoting, "any such actions decided by other parties are completely illegal," end quote. In related news, the Syrian prime minister said Monday that armed rebels in Syria had two options: to return where they came from or be killed. The minister's remarks came from a session of the ministerial committee tasked with implementing the political program outlined by the president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad. Now, this from Neil Clark, writing in RussiaToday.com, "The prospects of a peaceful solution to the Syrian crisis is still a long way off. We won't get an end to the violence," he writes, "until the foreign powers who have been fueling the conflict, the U.S. included, radically change their policies toward the country." RT reports that following the visit of U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry to Moscow this week, the U.S. and Russia have reiterated their commitment to bring the sides of the Syrian conflict to the negotiating table, and that they have announced an international conference to be called by the end of May, which will serve as a follow-up to the Geneva communique. "The Geneva communique should be a roadmap to a new Syria, not a forgotten piece of paper, Lavrov said. So it is time to toast the imminent end of a terrible bloody conflict, which, according to UN estimate, in February has cost 70,000 lives. RT writes, "The Syrian government has for a long time shown a willingness to talk, but their readiness to make compromises to find peaceful political solution to the conflict has not been matched by the so-called rebels. Instead of using their influence to pressurize anti-government militia to lay down their arms and negotiate directly with Damascus, the foreign supporters of the rebels have been egging them on to intensify their campaign to violently overthrow the Syrian government. It's a campaign which has involved some appalling acts of terrorism, such as last week's bombing of Main Square in Damascus, in which 13 people were killed." And departing from the text, and you may have recalled from the news last few days, Syrian rebel eating the heart of one of his victims. Returning to the text, "These countries stoking the conflict in Syria have up to now not been interested in compromises or allowing the Syrian people to decide their own future, as the new 2012 constitution allows them to do, but have been hell-bent on achieving regime change for geostrategic reasons, most importantly to knock out the strongest regional ally of Iran." Once again, this is Russia's take on this through Russia Today, RT.com. They write, "Despite John Kerry's support for an international conference, he still has to rule out direct U.S. military aid to the rebels. When asked about the bill recommending the direct arming of the rebels, which is before Congress, Kerry said that the future of the bill would depend on some degree to the state of the evidence in respect to chemical weapons. Yet only a few days ago, Carlo Del Ponte of the UN Commission of Inquiry said there was no indication at all that the Syrian government had used chemical weapons. On the contrary, she said there were strong concrete suspicions that the opponents of the government themselves had used them." And again, departing from the text, you will recall the video in which the rebels killed bunnies with poison gas and threatened humans with a similar result. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187, talking about global warming, talking about Syria, and Mike is on the line.
Morning.
Good morning.
Hey, I have it's kind of aching at me concern, this story not being told within the story, is this the IRS investigation of all groups, not just right-wing groups. Seems to me that any news coverage I've heard so far is just a build-up, and no one's mentioning the obvious yet, which will come out to light, that there should be more investigation into these organizations, especially these new ones, because there's lots of journalism about the fact that these are just oligarchy, right-wing, corporate front groups that are fraudulent because they're not supposed to be used for political purposes and financial purposes, which, of course, they are. So I don't think the right-wingers and the Koch brothers, for instance, I don't think they're going to want too much investigation into this IRS thing because it will expose that.
Well, it would expose the fact that 501c4 was created really with the idea of allowing very rich people to influence the elections, and that is, of course, what is happening through the Tea Party. And yet, I think you would probably agree with me that this sort of partisan targeting has always been unacceptable. It was unacceptable when Nixon targeted the anti-war left in the 70s, and it's unacceptable now. Returning to RT.com about Syria, they say, if the U.S. stance leaves a lot to be desired, the position of the U.K. in relation to Syria is arguably even worse. The U.K.'s neoconservative-dominated government is trying all it can to pressurize other EU countries to lift the Syrian arms embargo. Today we hear that they have sent a discussion paper to other EU members, making the case either for a total lifting of the ban or an easing of it. And of course, they are talking about arming the rebels. Now, this from Times of Israel. Israel has warned Damascus that if President Assad chooses to hit back at Israel for any further Israel military strikes, Israel will bring down his regime. What's wrong with that sentence? I'll just say it again. Israel has warned Damascus that if President Assad chooses to hit back at Israel for any further Israeli military strikes, Israel will bring down his regime. Thought I'd just let that hang there. That's about as belligerent as you can get. We're going to hit you, and don't you dare hit back. Yeah. Peace talks, anyone? Returning to Times of Israel, an Israeli official confirmed Wednesday night that a dramatic and unprecedented message to this effect had been conveyed to Damascus. The report said that Israel's position to this effect also came up during the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's emergency meeting in Russia on Tuesday with President Vladimir Putin, during which Netanyahu also told Putin of Israel's profound opposition to Russia's sale of sophisticated S-300 missile defense batteries to Assad. Now, departing from that article, I'll bet they object to that, and that's the only substantial thing that I've heard of that could stop war cold. From Wikipedia, the S-300 is regarded as one of the most potent anti-aircraft missiles currently fielded. Its radars have the ability to simultaneously track up to 100 targets while engaging up to 12. S-300 missile deployment time is 5 minutes. The S-300 missiles are sealed rounds and require no maintenance over their lifetime. An evolved version of the S-300 is the S-400, which is even more capable and can strike missiles as well. So put those things into the theater and that just kind of puts a kink into the plans. Had a little bit more information about the USS Nimitz showing up to torment the North Koreans some more with an exercise with South Korean ships. So that whole business isn't over yet. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Please stay tuned for more of the incomparable radio zine. Tune in on KBOO.fm. And as I was suggesting, please look at our list of programming because there are some delightful things on there. And I very much enjoy listening to KBOO, especially for music in the evenings. But right now, coming up, more on KBOO.
I'm TJ Ravenwolf, Koi Khan Athabaskan Muscogee Creek from Alaska. I'm here in Portland, Oregon. I'd like to invite you to an evening of Native American art, music, storytelling, and traditional indigenous foods. Come join us for the Indigenous Experience Northwest at the Scottish Rites Ainsworth Event Center on May 30th, starting at 4 p.m. Music starts at 7:30 with public speaking, art, storytelling. And at 7:30, upstairs in the ballroom, we have four Native American Music Award winners performing: Keith Sokola, Cody Blackbird, Swill Canem, double feature with Big B and Nate with the Brian Harrison Trio. For more information, go to the Indigenous Experience NW.
Naked, Lynn Fitch, Raw and Exposed, Sunday, May 19th, 6:30 to 8 p.m., and Monday, May 20th, 7 to 8 p.m. Hear the untold truths about the KABU Station Navigator. Ask your own probing questions. What experience does she really have? Where did she come from? What was she doing in China in 1995? What secrets is she hiding? How does she know Arlo Guthrie? And where is KABU headed with her at the helm? Sunday, May 19th, 6:30 to 8 p.m., and Monday, May 20th, 7 to 8 p.m. Listen to the live interview with Lynn as she unveils herself and stands naked before KABU listeners.
Well, this is Fight the Empire. My name is Per Fagrang, and my guest is Gilad Atzmon, who grew up in Israel, now lives in London, and he's a jazz musician and a philosopher and the author of a recent book, The Wandering Who. And lately he's touched a controversy about what to do in Syria. So Gilad, welcome to KABU.
I'm very delighted to be with you here.
So why don't we talk about this? It started with a solidarity group of solidarity activists, including Ilan Pape and
Norman Finkelstein and Tariq Ali.
And they put out a statement basically about Syria, laying all the blame on Bashar Assad. Why don't we go on from there?
Yeah, I'm not talking from a perspective of a Bashar al-Assad supporter. I'm actually interfering with this debate from presenting a non-interventionist perspective. I really want to know, what is it that makes people who live in Britain or America capable, or what does it make it possible for them to suggest what is the right thing for the Syrian people? And I ask this question because, as far as I'm aware, and I'm sure that I'm correct here, both Tariq Ali, Norman Finkelstein, and Ilan Pape are basically anti-Zionists. They definitely don't support Netanyahu. But bizarrely enough, 3 days after they signed on this petition, Benjamin Netanyahu ordered a heavy bombardment of Syria. And to a certain extent, this clumsy statement, signed by many progressive and leftists, gave actually green light for Israeli intervention that can make this conflict into a global conflict. I expect those progressive thinkers to be slightly more clever, but maybe my request is in vain.
Well, actually, they came out in support of what they call sort of the Syrian people, which is very divided, but we can presume they mean the kind of the secular Democrats, not the jihadi forces.
It's a very, very problematic. Mm-hmm. And why? because when these clashes started, I think 2 years ago, and now, it was clearly the Syrian people in the very beginning. It was a non-violent resistance and so on, and they met a quite brutal reaction by the government. We are all aware of it. But now the conflict is very, very different. Mm-hmm. Now it is, we are all aware that rebels are largely mercenaries from the whole region. Many of them are jihadists and Salafite. The Syrian army is fighting against them, and this is the army of the Syrian people. And it is more than likely, as Robert Fisk of the Independent suggests, they are not fighting for Assad. They're fighting to maintain the character of their country. And again, I ask, what is it that makes Ilan Pape finds himself in a league together with Israel, Qatar, so-called Al-Qaeda, and America? I don't understand.
And Saudi Arabia, too.
I don't understand it. And again, if I have to formulate this question in a philosophical manner, I ask, what is it that entitles A, who lives in B, to intervene in the life of C, who lives in D? And this is the issue, and I think that it's about time the progressive thinkers, or those who call themselves progressive thinkers, engage in